on air, online, on digital, and the ABC Listen app. The Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
And coming up today, the berry harvest delay in the north of the state.
Feels like winter hasn't really left us. Spring only just touched us on the shoulder and summer's yet to arrive. So we are delayed with a lot of production.
And also in the south of the state, delays through the weather.
It was a slow start and a late start for us. The weather kept kicking us on. But the fruit quality is really good. We've got nice big strawberries and we're heading into a good season, even though it's late.
Yeah, even though it's late, the berries are finally being picked after delays in most parts of the state due to the unseasonal weather conditions through spring. G'day, Tony Briscoe with you on this Thursday with the first half of the program coming to you online. Second half of the show will be lunchtime in the cricket. Also coming up today, more research into combating aphids and workers allegedly underpaid at a Victorian fruit farm with legal efforts underway there. We'll check that story in just a moment. Also, we'll check the latest on the weather as well as taking your thoughts via that text line. You can still contact us, 0438 922 936 is that number. First up, the Fair Work Ombudsman has commenced legal action against a vegetable farm in Victoria for allegedly underpaying 28 migrant workers more than $645,000. Facing court is Bulmer Farms, which produces vegetables including lettuce, spinach and broccoli in Lindenau in the East Gippsland region. Fair Work Ombudsman Anna Booth says the workers feared speaking up due to retribution from their employer.
There was a referral that we received from the Federal Department of Employment and Workplace Relations in relation to conduct from December 2019 through to December 2023, so over those 4 years. And it was in relation to 28 migrant workers, actually PALM workers, the Pacific Australia Labour Mobility Scheme workers. And they came from Kiribati, Timor-Leste and the Solomon Islands. And as you said, at the top of the program, they were underpaid over $645,000. Now, Bulmer Farms has repaid around $45,000 to those workers, but that obviously leaves a pretty big gap, and that is what we are pursuing in court, and we're also pursuing penalties.
So what were some of the working conditions that you found that led to this underpayment?
Well, look, the fundamental problem was Bulmer Farms' payment on an annual basis, so flat rates for all hours worked, and that amount was insufficient to cover the hours that they worked and insufficient to meet the minimum entitlements under the Horticulture Award. So the workers were paid anywhere between $884 and $1,105 per week. Now, that was for a 38-hour week, but they actually were required to work more than 38 hours, indeed, for more than half of the time, and in 7% of cases, more than 50 hours a week. So the result of that, of course, was underpayment, in particular of overtime rates and penalty rates for weekend and public holiday work. And look, Annie, you know, the reason that we are so concerned about this is that time and time again, we make it clear that people have to be paid for each hour they work, and that migrant workers, particularly, all workers have to be paid the same. And it's just really important that migrant workers, particularly visa holders who are our guests, you know, invited to our country to support the industries that we have, are paid equally to Australian workers. And that didn't happen in this case.
And I saw in the information that was put out from the Ombudsman today that some of these reports go back to 2019. So it's quite a while ago that some of these cases were first reported, I guess.
Look, that is right. And that's not uncommon, I have to say, with the Fair Work Ombudsman. These investigations, you know, take some time. I'm not actually sure exactly when the referral came from the department, but you're right. The alleged underpayment occurred between December of 2019 and December of 2023. So I said 4 years before, but probably got my maths wrong there. It's 3 years, isn't it?
Yeah, that's all right. And as I said at the top there, it's a total sum of around $645,000, but individually a bit of a range, somewhere between 1,500 to 39,000 for some people.
Yeah, that's right. Of course. So it does, of course, depend on each worker and how much time they were required to work. And I stress required to work. And as I said, in 7% of cases, workers were required to work more than 50 hours per week.
And the Ombudsman, you're taking this business to court to litigate. You know, why do you want to take this business through the legal process?
Well, look, obviously we've been in discussions with Bulmer Farm for quite some time, and as I say, they have repaid $45,000, so that's what they consider, or $42,000 actually, I've just checked the figure, that's what they consider is owed, and we don't agree with that, so we think it's more like the $645,000 that I've quoted, and that's a really large amount of money, and these workers, being migrant workers and in particular Palms scheme workers, that is temporary visa holders, they are a real priority for the Fair Work Ombudsman because they're workers who are in an unfamiliar environment. They've come at our request. Employers ask these workers to come and do the work. It's so important that we make it really clear to all employers that they must pay these workers and treat these workers equally with all Australian workers. Bulmer Farms in this case has committed 15 separate contraventions, and we just could not walk past this conduct.
You mentioned that you've been in discussion with Bulmer Farms for quite a long time. How long would you say that's been?
Well, it must be from the point of the referral from the Department of Employment and Workplace Relations. When I say discussions, of course, I'm talking about an investigation, which includes conversations. I can't tell you exactly when the investigation started, but it must have been after 2019 and before the present day.
And you're seeking a full repayment of that $645,000?
Yes, we are. We allege that that is the amount. We will have to establish that. We also allege record-keeping and payslip breaches, and so we'll be pursuing that as well. We also allege deductions have been unlawfully made for things like AFAs and amounts over and above the actual cost, health insurance and things like that. So there's, as I said, 15 separate contraventions, so there will be quite a lot of evidence that will need to be led.
Are these workers still working there?
These particular workers, I don't have visibility of myself. I suspect not, but the business itself is still running, still supplying its salad vegetables, and there will be workers there now, but I don't know whether any of those workers who are currently employed are subject of our litigation, I'm afraid.
This might be a question for the courts and lawyers, but what are the consequences that Bulmers could face if they're found guilty of these charges?
Yeah, well, look, there's specific penalties. I can only quote what the maximum is, $93,900 per breach, but it is always for the court to decide what the appropriate penalty is.
And how many breaches were there again?
Yeah, 15 is what I'm informed by my people.
Yeah, so that could add up quite quickly.
It could.
And I guess with Palm Scheme workers, you know, are they more vulnerable to these kind of breaches of unfair work and unfair pay?
Well, I would say that temporary visa holders are more vulnerable. The Palm Scheme itself is a highly regulated scheme, and in fact, we conduct regular reviews of Palm Scheme employers for the Palm Scheme owners, that are the Department of Employment and Workplace Relations and the Department of Foreign Affairs. But your question really goes to the state of mind of the people here in Australia under those visas. And we hear from them directly, as well as from their representatives, that they are afraid. They do fear they're losing their jobs and losing their visas. Now, in fact, we have visa protections in Australia. We have two new pilot programs run by the Department of Home Affairs to protect people's visas when they're being exploited, but often they don't know that. We also conduct for every arrival, we have an arrival briefing, but you can say all of those things, but when people face what they face in reality, they can still be very afraid because objectively they are precarious workers.
How can people report any potential breaches of unfair pay or unfair work? Like, where would you, what would you suggest?
Well, look, I mean, workers, of course, can go to their union if they're a member. They can come to us. They can either come to us through our info line, which is 13 13 94, or they can come to us anonymously through our anonymous reporting tool. Employers, if they want to report, because let's face it, this is also a situation that disturbs many employers as well, who are doing the right thing. They can come via their employer organisation to us, or also through the Fair Work Ombudsman reporting system. It's also important to say that workers can get an interpreter by ringing 13 14 50. And on our website, we have just a plethora of information specifically focused on agriculture and also specifically focused on migrant workers. So, and often it's been translated professionally into many languages, and we have an automatic translator. So there is a lot of ability for both employers and workers to get information about their rights and obligations. But if they do feel that they just don't know and they want to know whether they are being paid correctly, they can contact us. And if they have a report to make of what they sincerely believe is a breach of the Fair Work Act, as I said, they can come to us through our info line or through our anonymous reporting tool.
That's Fair Work Ombudsman Anna Booth speaking with Annie Brown about the Ombudsman commencing legal action against a vegetable farm in Victoria for allegedly underpaying 28 migrant workers more than $645,000. Now, we reached out to the company and received a statement from Bulmers Farms. It says they're working with the Ombudsman to rectify unintentional underpayments and deductions made by the company to 28 current and former palm workers. They say 15 of the 28 palm employees are still employed by Bulmer Farms. Company statement says they are, quote, taking immediate action to quantify and confirm the exact amount owed to each affected palm employee. They've engaged Workforce Analytics, an independent third party, to assist. As soon as they've quantified the underpayments, they'll immediately act to pay the outstanding monies owed to each employee. And these were genuine mistakes, not intentional decisions, and they are correcting them. They expect this process to be completed by late January or early February next year. And they go on to say that despite using Palm Scheme workers for more than 10 years, it's the first time any concerns have been raised, and they are reviewing payroll compliance and Palm Scheme administration processes. Well, the Invasive Species Council has written to the state government suggesting a number of recommendations to tighten firearm regulations. It comes in the wake of the Bondi Beach massacre, where 15 people were killed and dozens wounded after two men opened fire on the celebration on Sunday evening. Commonwealth and all state governments are investigating gun ownership reforms, including restrictions on the number and types of weapons that people can own. Chief Executive at the ISC, Jack Goff, told Hamish Cole stricter regulations are needed.
Look, it's totally reasonable that people are profoundly shocked and grieving following the massacre in Bondi, and that there is an expectation that there are clarity and potentially changes around firearms legislation to make sure that there are no loopholes allowing people to be able to use firearms as weapons to use on the populace. And I guess fundamentally for the Invasive Species Council, our position is that firearms are a tool and they're not a toy. And that really means that they're an important, legitimate tool used in professional, coordinated feral animal control programs. Having strict regulatory frameworks around that is important. Having access for landholders to firearms to be able to do some of those feral animal control, all of that is really important. We have written to the New South Wales government today to detail some recommendations that we'd make around some particular changes that we think would ensure we've got robust firearm regulation, but also ensure that we don't have changes which mean that the critical operational capacity of licensed landholders and professionals in essential pest animal control programs is impacted.
Yeah, a number of these recommendations you're looking at we'll touch on. One of them is around the types of weapons that people can own. What's your position on where that legislation should go to?
Look, I guess our recommendations to the government are about, you know, this is where you should go if you're worried about feral animal control. Decisions, you know, beyond that really are not about feral animal control. And one of the clear ones of that is that what's called the straight pull or the push button firearms. And it appears in this Bondi massacre that that one was used. And the concern we've got with these firearms is that they're essentially a way to get around CAT-C, CAT-D requirements around semi-automatic weapons, because they're classed as Category A or B, so they're available to people that are, you know, maybe just amateur hunters, that sort of thing. But the reality is that they are high rate of fire weapons that mimic semi-automatic capability. For some of them, you can discharge an entire magazine in under 10 seconds. So we don't think they're necessary. We've been consulting with professionals. Professionals do not use them. They've got CAT C and D access to semi-automatic weapons. They use them instead. This is really just a loophole for amateur hunters to be able to access a bigger weapon, which is not needed. So that should be closed.
We also saw in these events that one of the shooters had legally accessed six firearms and had legally owned those. Do you think there needs to be an introduction of a cap on how many weapons people can own?
A cap, that's a matter for the government, I guess, in terms of the public safety side of things. But in terms of what would be required for effective feral animal control, we would be comfortable with people not being able to access more than five firearms. Having a maximum primary allowance of three firearms is sufficient for most general pest animal control. There would be, for some people, a need in compelling and documented circumstances to potentially have up to two additional firearms. That could be justified, but a cap at five, which is in line with Western Australia, and I think is something that governments are considering, that wouldn't impact on feral animal control. But going below that potentially could. And so, for example, you can imagine a landholder, they may have a .22 long rifle for small-scale rabbit control, a .22 Magnum, say, for trapped animals like pigs that need to be dispatched, or a shotgun for their close range responses, 0.223 for medium sized animals, and a 0.308 for some of the larger animals like feral pigs and deer at long range. So there's five different guns for different circumstances that could be compelling need for a landholder. Above that, you're probably just having more weapons for the sake of it.
That's Jack Gough from the Invasive Species Council speaking there with Hamish Cole about firearm regulations. On the country, a mother-daughter duo have just started a Brumby sanctuary in the Upper Hunter Valley. After years advocating against the culling of Brumbies in national parks in New South Wales, Shannon Lawrence-Bade and daughter Ayla Jennings-Bade decided to use their own property to retrain and rehome them. Reporter Amelia Bernasconi stopped by the Giants Creek property to meet Ayla and Shannon and some of the horses.
We've got Rosie here we're standing in front of, she's a lovely girl. She comes from Kosciuszko and she came here with a halter on her face, a rope halter on her face. So it was actually stuck on her face for 6 months until she came here. It's taken within the first two weeks, my main aim was getting it off her face because it was restricting her mouth movement and the discomfort when she's chewing, just around her ears, around her mouth. So I had to actually tame her to remove that because she didn't know any other way. She wasn't tame. So now that's removed, she can just slip into being a domesticated horse.
And just looking at Rosie now, she's beautiful dapple grey and she's just sort of standing there looking at us every so often with pricked ears. And
yeah.
I can't believe you've only had her here for 3 weeks.
Yeah, she's really settled in. Our next aim is to just get her a bit more comfortable with myself and other people and build her a little paddock so she can wander around a bit more.
Because you spoke about the trauma that these horses carry, and you know, you've got a stallion over there, and you know people sort of know stallions for their big masculine testosterone and things, you know, like you're working with horses who haven't had a lot to do with humans in, like you say, that expecting something from them sense. So how do you start to try and handle them and calm them down?
The first thing I do walking into a round yard is gently ask for attention. So you're asking for a conversation. So you what I do is I just ask for them to put an eye or an ear on me, and I'll step away when they do that, and I'll build on that, and then I'll introduce a stick, and the stick I'll ask them to touch that eventually, and then that, because they're touching that, the stick touches them on their face, and I'm cutting heaps of little pieces, but just to get a broad idea, and then eventually the stick will be all over their body, and then the stick will help teach them to yield off the pressure both ways, and that builds up to when the halter, because when the halter goes on their face, we don't want them to think, oh, what's that pressure? Mm. We want them prepared, so when it's on them, they're ready, they're not frightened of when it's being done up, they're not frightened, they feel that pressure and they go, oh, yeah, okay, if I move off that, it's same but different. So you build up those pieces, so that's basically it. Broken down.
Yeah, that's a long story short. I'm sure there's lots of hours in there. Ayla, tell me a bit about the horses that you've got here and where they've come from.
So we've got Rosie, who's she was trapped, and then she ended up in two other situations.
Yeah.
And then she's came here. We've got Zippy, who was transferred from another sanctuary, was showing behavioural issues that he was just basically having trouble communicating and in pain. And then Bailey's came from the same sanctuary. Just as a cult, I think the trouble sanctuaries and, you know, all these people taking on the Brumbies from the actual rehomers is the cults. The cults seem to become an issue. There's that that initial fee of gelding them, but also keeping them away from mares and having the right facilities.
And the handling of them. They need the handling quicker. Where's the other ones? A lot of people don't, modern sanctuaries don't have the privilege of having a trainer on board, so they just left, and the colts, they must get handled, and so it becomes a bit of a task for them. Yeah,
you can understand that. So you've got, was it two colts you've got here?
We've got a stallion and a colt, and then we've got up in this paddock, we've got three that came together from Goulburn. They were quite poorly, so we've been working a lot on getting them up to condition so that they can be trained and be in a healthy mindset.
You mentioned there the starting point is kind of getting their condition back to standard, which is very costly, I imagine, whether it's vet bills or feed bills. Tell me a bit about that and how you guys have gone in funding some of those bigger costs.
So everything's publicly funded. We rely on people just donating to cover the feed costs. It is quite expensive. We do spend quite a lot in comparison probably to other sanctuaries on feed, but we're very, very firm on horses having enough hay, and understanding that that is a vital part of them needing to be healthy enough to go on and learn in a good environment with a healthy mindset. I think everyone here has a sponsor. That's somebody who from the public chooses to sponsor this horse, and they pay a fee every month that basically contributes to feeding these horses. All of these ones have sponsors now.
Yeah. You just did a bit of a hay drive. Is that the right term for it? How did that go?
Really, really well. So we've just reached the final couple of bales. We've managed to exceed it. So we had, the goal was 100 bales, which for 18 each, which ends up being $1,800. We've actually managed to exceed that because we got bales just a little bit cheaper. Mm-hmm. So I think we'll end up with 120 bales out of the hay drive. Yeah.
That's so good. And unfortunately, in the Hunter, we're having a pretty ordinary season. So how long will that look after the horses here for?
I think we're going through probably 40 bales every 2 weeks. Yeah. At the moment, we're pretty limited on grass here, which is typical of this season and stuff. Hay is going, we're going through it pretty quickly, and especially having the ones in training in yards, they've almost got to have access to hay 24/7. Yeah, we go through it pretty quickly.
Ayla Jennings-Bade and Shannon Lauren-Bade, New Dawn Brumby Sanctuary at Giants Creek, west of Musselbrook, speaking with Upper Hunter reporter Amelia Bernasconi. Well, it is Christmas. Have you got an artificial or real Christmas tree this year? At Winky in South Australia's Riverland, the Plush family this year are harvesting and selling their first crop of Christmas trees. They diversified from oranges to the niche crop 3 years ago. Eliza Burlage visited Sarah and David Plush to see their trees.
Well, they're definitely taller than I am, and I'm not, what am I, not 6 foot, so they're well and truly 6-7 feet high.
Your kids were saying they were going to be taller than them by the time you're ready to harvest them, and you're ready to harvest them now.
we are ready. I reckon all three kids can probably stand on each other's shoulders and the trees would probably still be taller than them.
Definitely some of the trees I imagine are ones that you'd want to come out and measure them before you take them home, make sure they can fit through your doorway.
Definitely. I've been taking photos and I've been meaning to actually put a tape measure up. So they are looking pretty impressive.
And are these the native pine trees?
No, these are the radiata that we, first planted. The natives we only planted not quite 2 years ago, so they're not quite ready yet.
So you've had a bit of success, I guess, with this first crop, but how have you, tell me about how you've gotten to this stage.
My husband's probably done most of the work. In the early days, it was a lot of hand weeding while the trees were quite young and just keeping the water up to them. Keeping the weeds down and the water up is pretty much what we've done over the last 3 years.
How thirsty are these radiata pines?
Not too bad now. I think David only waters a couple of times a week. So a lot more, we've had to water a lot more this year. But when we first put them in, we didn't have to water them much at all. Probably been a bit more thirsty this year with a bit less rain. So
you're going to be selling some Christmas trees for people this year.
We are, yes. Probably won't have people. I'd love to be able to have people come out, but not this year. This year will be done more through photos on Facebook and we can then deliver the trees to them. So yeah, we'll just take photos. They can pick what number tree they want and we'll do it that way.
Have you had much interest in your trees so far since letting people know that you guys will be having Christmas trees available?
We're sort of slowly starting to get the word out there, I guess, just letting people know that we are here and that we do have some trees available.
Well, since beginning your Christmas tree venture a couple of years ago and they're obviously looking pretty good, have you had other people coming to talk to you about looking into them? Because obviously people are definitely talking about diversifying in the Riverland if they can, if they want to stay here.
No, we haven't actually. We do sort of talk to friends and that sort of thing, and they're like, what, who, why would you do Christmas trees? And a bit sort of surprised, I guess, when they find out that it is what we're doing. But no, haven't had too many other people wanting to get into the Christmas tree business yet.
Well, they look absolutely beautiful. Sarah, should we ask David a few questions, do you think? David, how are you feeling about this venture to keep yourself close to your family and keep your family in the region?
These first batch of trees have been probably not too bad to look after because they took off pretty easily. But the second batch that we were trying to get going has been a lot more frustrating and hard work because they started to be, when we planted them, they were a lot smaller, and so they've just taken so much more effort to try and get moving. But I hope that when they do get moving that we'll end up getting to similar heights, or maybe not quite as high as we have got these ones. But last year when I looked at these, Sarah asked me whether we can cut them, and I said, they're only a bit over just 6 foot. Why would you cut them now? And people want it bigger than that. And now I'm looking at it going, maybe if Christmas had come, would have been a June thing, it would have been the right time.
Christmas in July, perhaps.
Yeah, pretty much. But no, some of these are quite tall, and I suppose if we have to trim them back down a bit or cut some limbs on the bottom to make them some shorter, then that's what we have to do.
So you've got the native pines are over there.
Yes.
How are they looking? Some were planted at the same time?
So our original crop was six rows of trees, and they're all pine radiatas. And our next set of rows, so there's about the same amount of length and distance and number of trees, but we only did three rows, and it was two rows of pine radiata, and one row we decided to go with natives. And some of our large and early natives have taken off quite well. They've just got a... they'll probably be another year or so before they're ready. And some of the bigger pine radiatas have also started to get going and get up. But there are a lot of them took a rather big hit due to the weather and trying to keep weeds and trying to keep on water. So they're a bit behind where I really wanted them to be by now, but that's what happens.
And as you said before, you guys have pulled some citrus trees since our last visit, and this was always, I guess you were talking about this possibly being a bit of a transition away from the citrus trees because the industry's not quite been the right ticket for you guys in any farm income.
Yeah, well, this was a block of citrus, and I suppose it was a bulb block that did struggle to have attention and from family side of things, and as obviously the industry struggled, so it became a case of why keep running citrus on it, whereas obviously someone suggested the trees, we went with trees. We don't have to water them quite as much as heavily, and I haven't put any nutrients into the ground or anything. It's literally plant them and let them do their thing and see how we go. Maybe in the future I have to look into more nutrients or whether they've got pests or not. but so far I haven't seen any. So we're lucky in that department.
Yeah, that's David Plush, along with partner Sarah, speaking to Eliza Burlage from the Winky Christmas Tree Farm in South Australia's Riverland. They diversified from oranges to the niche crop Christmas trees around 3 years ago, and they're having a great time doing just that.
It's the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Yeah, g'day. Welcome to part two of the Country Hour, a shortened version today with lunchtime in the cricket. Coming up, the berries are late, but things are on track now at a couple of farms in the north and the south of the state. And we'll look at research into treating aphids, all that coming up. But first, time to check the latest news headlines with Michael Della Fontana.
Thank you, Tony. Health Minister Bridget Archer says she's considering new measures to ease congestion in Tasmania's emergency departments in order to break a deadlock with the state's nurses' union. Ms Archer says she's committed to reducing the transfer of care timeframe and is working with the union to ease their concerns that it would compromise patient safety and overload hospital staff. A funeral service will be held in Melbourne later today for Bondi victim Rivian Morrison. The 61-year-old was among the 15 people gunned down and dozens injured when a father and son opened fire at the Hunnicutt by the Sea event on Sunday in Sydney. A video of Mr. Morrison emerged of him throwing a brick at one of the shooters moments before he was fatally shot. And Australia has made several early breakthroughs on day two of a third Ashes test at the Adelaide Oval. Captain Pat Cummins marked his return from injury by dismissing Zach Crawley before Nathan Lyon grabbed two wickets in one over. England is currently 3 for 53. Earlier, the home side was bowled out for 371, with Mitch Stark scoring a half century, while Jofra Archer took 5 wickets. More news at 1.
Thank you, Michael. Let's check the latest on the weather now. Ursula Connor joins us from the Bureau. G'day, Ursula.
Good afternoon, Tony.
What's happening out there with the weather?
Well, a fair bit of cloud over the state today. We do have a trough that's just sort of making its way from south to north, bringing a little bit of sort of light rain and showery activity with it, but not too much of that has made it into the gauges across the state. Those in the north will start to see a few light showers picking up sort of through the afternoon as that trough moves through that area. As we move into tomorrow, we'll see some sort of easterly winds start to pick up, so those showers will contract down to sort of the east and southeast of the state for sort of the morning and middle part of the day, and then we'll start to see a low pressure system approaching the west sort of later in the day, so that will start to see some showers developing about the north sort of in the afternoon, maybe the chance of an isolated thunderstorm or two about the northwest tomorrow, Tony.
And what sort of temperatures have we got at the moment, Ursula?
At the moment, King Island and Scottsdale take the cake at 25 degrees at the moment. Elsewhere, we've got 20 degrees in Hobart, 22 in Lonnie, 20 in Devonport, and 20 degrees in St Helens as well. So a fairly mild day out there today, Tony.
And looking at Friday and heading into the weekend, what's the outlook?
Yeah, so as we move into the weekend, that low pressure system that's going to approach the state sort of late tomorrow is going to move over us on Saturday. So that will start to see showers developing statewide, possibly even some sort of early morning thunderstorms, especially about the east coast on Saturday morning before that sort of all clears out to the east during the evening. Then on Sunday, we're actually just watching a bit of a low pressure system which is looking to develop over the southeastern parts of the mainland and make its way down over Tassie. So at this stage, it looks like we're going to have a mostly fine morning on Sunday, and then into the afternoon, we'll start to see showers developing about the north, and they'll become pretty widespread across the state as that low moves overhead, possibly even quite heavy through parts of the east coast and even into the southeast as well, with that rain continuing sort of overnight into Monday. So at this stage, we're looking at rainfall totals sort of Sunday night and into Monday around 10 to 15 millimetres across the whole state and up to sort of 20 to 30 about the east and northeast, possibly even some isolated higher totals with that system, Tony.
And warnings?
In terms of the warnings, we currently have a strong wind warning for the western coastal waters from southeast Cape to Sandy Cape, and tomorrow we see a strong wind warning for western and northern waters from southeast Cape around to Edison Point.
And the coastal waters and swell.
Yeah, so today we're looking at those western-northwesterly winds around 10 to 20 knots, but then they are tending south to southeasterly at around 15 to 25 knots in the late afternoon as that trough comes through. We'll see those east to southeasterly winds continuing into tomorrow morning, possibly reaching up to around 30 knots in parts of the southwest. And then they'll start to tend east and northeasterly tomorrow afternoon and increase into sort of 30 knots through the north as well. In terms of the swells through the west and south, we're looking at a west to southwesterly 1.5 to 2.5 metres. In the north, a westerly below 1 metre, and in the east, a southerly below 1 metre. Currently got Cape Sorel with a significant wave height of 1.8 metres and Maria Island 1 metre.
Thank you, Ursula.
Cheers, Tony.
All the best. Coming up in just a moment, we'll look at the berries being late.
As each day begins,
get the facts you need to stay informed.
Every day, across your day,
stay with Australia's trusted news source.
Stay in the know with ABC News.
Go to news.abc.net.au or download the ABC News app.
Coast to coast, this is the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
With warmer temps forecast for the next few days, berry growers would be breathing a sigh of relief. At Hillwood Berries in the north, strawberry volumes are well down on where they should be for this time of year. Farm manager Simon Dornoff's confident production will pick up with a bit more sunshine.
Yeah, it's been a challenging start to our 2025-2026 berry season. It feels like winter hasn't really left us. Spring only just touched us on the shoulder and summer's yet to arrive. So we are delayed with a lot of production. Looking at some numbers this morning, we'd forecast to have picked about 410 tonnes of strawberries and we're sitting more around 260 tonnes of strawberries. So we are behind forecast volumes. That's meant that our workforce has had less berries in front of them to pick, which has been challenging for our workforce because they're obviously here to earn money and earn dollars to send home. What we've done to help those guys though is delay some of the next arrivals coming in so that they would actually extend their work time here as we have less work for them. But that's going to change. The fruit's all loading up onto the crops and our curves are on the increase now, which is promising. We just need good warm days ahead of us.
So you have been able to place some of your pickers in other states so they can have work and then come to you when that fruit is ripe?
We have a farm in Queensland that finished its production in late October, early November, and we had strategically had a placement for our workforce in South Australia picking blueberries, so a like-for-like crop, just with another fellow grower that we help out. We had about 120 workers up there, and the nature of Australian environments is they've been quite on time and having quite a good season, and it's even extending, so they've requested to keep our workforce a little bit longer, which in turn's actually helped us to not have to have them arrive here with not as much to pick. So that has actually helped us out and we've been fortunate in that sense. However, talking about if we had a normal season, that could have been a different story and we might have been running around looking for workers. So in that sense, I guess it's fortunate.
What have you done in the last 12 months at this site at Hillwood? Have you expanded or mixed up the product that you're growing here?
We haven't expanded here at Hillwood. We've been planting in a nursery sense some new blueberry varieties that we've been trialling with our site out at East Devonport, the old Shima site. That has been promising, so we've got we've been bulking up that supply of plants that will hopefully be expanding to next season for that production window, which generally hits around the late April, mid-May period of blueberries, which is a difficult supply period for Australian blueberries.
What's unique about this variety?
It's called a De Novo blueberry variety, and it's unique to Driscoll's. It's certainly they stumbled upon it in their breeding programs, and the reason it's unique, in a typical blueberry plant, people will prune certain branches and you've got sort of next year's fruit on last year's wood, where this particular variety you can cut it back to quite hard, almost like you'd cut a rose back, I think. And it will produce fruit on the same grown cane in the same season, hence the delay, because it's got to grow the branch and then fruit the fruit. So that gives it delayed supply of fruit versus the more typical northern high bush varieties that we grow, but it allows us to essentially produce fruit in a delayed window. It is a bit heart in the mouth, because if you do get a cold end to the season, it can pull up stumps and you can't actually get the full crop ripened. So it's certainly something we're looking at and doing it in trial stages before we invest quite all the capital required for a full scale.
Strawberries, how are they looking?
Slow, but promising. I think, if anything, the colder weather's allowed the plants to set up nicely. We are probably looking at a very busy January for supply. We're looking out at the tunnels now, and there's a lot of flowers, a lot of green fruit hanging off those. So there'll be ample January supply of strawberries. We're just hoping that it doesn't. All growers don't all hit at once, and we have essentially a mini glut for a period.
You have had that before.
Yeah, it happened, and it generally happens in January through the way that the varieties peak, that along with Victorian production. So we really are at the mercy of what's going to happen in Victoria, because they're equally as delayed as we are on the market. So if they have a hot January, that could affect it. Equally, if they are growing outside, so they are a little bit more vulnerable to the conditions. So, however, we've been hoping for this warm weather to arrive, and it's yet to happen, so we may end up just having a mild summer and might be a little bit more gentle on the market than maybe what we're predicting.
Yes, Simon Dornoff, farm manager at Hillwood Berries on the East Tamar, chatting there to Larissa Smith. Well, in the south, it's been a delayed start to the berry season at one southern Tasmanian farm due to the weather conditions through spring. Pinata farm manager at Orielton, Jan Boysen, says they also had to cope with tunnel damage from the wild winds.
It was a slow start and a late start for us. The weather kept kicking us on. But the fruit quality is really good. We've got nice big strawberries, and we're heading into a good season, even though it's late.
What about the raspberries?
Not too bad either. The cold weather stopped the bees from coming in a little bit. We had a big issue with pollination early on. Raspberries is reliant on pollination. So that means we had misshapen fruit at the start of our season. Because the bees didn't do their work, they were a bit dormant with all the overcast weather. It's shaping up now, but it was a hard start for us. We do get hives in. We get enough hives in. We get four hives per hectare, but with the overcast and cool weather and the wind, the bees just weren't active. Okay. And the days that they were active, they were chasing better pollen, so they were heading over to the gum trees.
Right.
So it was just all weather-driven for us this season.
Production at the moment is in full swing. How many people have you got there?
We're heading towards our capacity. We've got about 150 pickers on site at the moment. We'll head into 200 staff on farm by Christmas.
And, of course, it's a pretty long season, isn't it?
It is. It is. Even though we started late, we'll crack on till probably May. Depends on how the weather treats us. We don't have confidence in the forecast at the moment.
I think everyone's shaking their head about the weather. Last time we spoke, you were subject to some damage from the winds. What happened there?
Yes, it didn't stop. The winds are relentless this year. So all up, we've lost 56 skins, the plastic on the tunnels, and we've lost three structures that the wind just folded them up. So we've had massive damages in that regard. We've managed to almost replace all of them. We're doing the last ones today. And I'm hoping the wind's going to stay away for a bit now.
So obviously that's affecting your production big time.
It is. We're lucky enough to have skilled labor that we've held on to for the last few years. So we've been able to put it back on as quick as we lost them. That was a real positive for us. So we managed to minimize that damage a lot. There is a bit of damage there. We're going to lose a bit of yield because of it, but because we got it on pretty quick, we mitigated that issue.
Now you say you're working through to more people coming towards Christmas. Did they get Christmas off, or you keep working?
The plants, they don't take holidays. So we'll have Christmas Day off. It's just we always give them Christmas Day off, but we work Boxing Day. We work New Year's if we have to. It's our peak. We got the most fruit coming on over Christmas.
And the packing plant, how's that going?
Yeah, good. We pack in field essentially. So the pack shed is a quality check for us, and we seal it, put it through the metal detectors and the check wires. So most of the work we do out in the field, but the pack shed's humming as well, like doing big days at the moment.
And where is all the fruit going?
A lot of it's going to Tasmania. We're sending a fair bit up the east coast of the mainland as well, going up to New South Wales and Queensland. But a big chunk's going in straight into Tassie, Coles and Woolies in Tassie.
So it's been a pretty rough start to the season, Jan, but you are travelling well now, and good luck for the future.
Yeah, well, that's farming, isn't it? We just got to adapt and work around it.
That's Pinata Berry Farm Manager Jan Boyson talking about the late start to berry picking season at Orielton in southern Tasmania due to the weather conditions heading into summer. New research in blue-green aphids has identified a gene which detoxifies chemicals used to treat the pest and creates insecticide resistance. Resistance in blue-green aphids was discovered in 2020, causes headaches for farmers growing pastures and some crops. Dr. Joshua Tia from the University of Melbourne's Australian Research Council says his research identifies a powerful gene which has important implications for the way farmers can try and treat the aphids.
My research has been looking at the genetics of insecticide resistance in the blue-green aphid. The blue-green aphid is a really important aphid pest of Australia's grain and pasture industry. It attacks crops like lucerne, clover, lentils. And since the early 2020s, insecticide resistance has been discovered in this aphid. And part of my research has been understanding what is the genetic basis of this resistance and what can we learn from this genetic data to inform the management of resistance in the field.
And what did your research find?
So originally, insecticide resistance was first reported in the early 2020s. It came off the back of control failures to chlorpyrifos insecticides. And then from that, it was discovered that, you know, resistance to insecticides is sort of quite well distributed across, Victoria, New South Wales and South Australia. And using genetics, we wanted to know whether or not there are different aphid populations that have evolved resistance to insecticides independently with each other, or whether or not resistance has evolved from one population and then spread more widely across Australia. And so basically using genetics, we were able to show that indeed there's a single, what we call a strain of blue-green aphid that appears to have evolved resistance once and then spread across different growing regions in Australia. And the really interesting thing about this resistance is that a reasonable component of this is underpinned by a single gene. And this gene is called an esterase. And basically, this little esterase gene is like a Swiss Army knife. It's able to basically detoxify a range of different insecticides that are used to control blue-green aphid.
So this esterase gene that you've effectively uncovered sounds very powerful in these aphid populations. Is that what you sort of found?
Yeah, so this esterase gene is really interesting because it basically allows blue-green aphid to detoxify a range of different insecticides. So currently in Australia, the two main insecticides that are registered for use in blue-green aphid are carbamates and organophosphate insecticides. And in some cases, there are also pyrethroids, which can be used in blue-green aphid control. And basically, this esterase is able to protect blue-green aphids from all three of these insecticides. And so why that's really problematic is that basically, well, there are no control options, really. Any one of the three major insecticide groups that are used to control blue-green aphid can be detoxified by this enzyme, by this gene. And it means that any time a farmer or a grower uses these insecticides on a resistant blue-green aphid, they are increasing selection, you know, for resistance, irrespective of which insecticide they use. And this is problematic because typically one of the recommendations when there's insecticide resistance is that farmers should rotate the chemicals that they're using. But in this case, if they were to rotate through carbamates, organophosphates, or pyrethroids, Actually, none of these would be very effective at trying to eliminate resistance, and all three of them would actually increase selection for resistance.
So now that you've established this esterase gene, is it possible to test aphids in paddocks and out in the field so that farmers and people know, you know, that they are resistant to the chemicals that are available?
Yeah, absolutely. So based on the research that we've done, we've developed some diagnostic tests using molecular data. So, you know, we can do a very simple genetic screen, kind of like how you would, you know, for other sort of you know, conditions in the medical field. You know, we can use a genetic test to identify, you know, resistant aphids and the presence of this particular esterase gene that contributes to resistance in the field.
What control options do farmers have with this particular aphid that is resistant?
You know, in terms of chemical control, there are not really a lot of options. Another chemical called sulfoxaflor, you know, the product name Transform, is, you know, registered for use in blue-green aphids. That seems to be still effective against blue-green aphids, and that's one of the recommended, you know, alternatives for chemical control. But one thing that, you know, other groups are looking into are the roles of things like natural enemies, predatory insects like ladybirds or parasitic wasps that can be used as non-chemical control options for blue-green aphid. And really interestingly, historically, there's been a lot of work invested into developing cultivars of, say, lucerne that are actually more resistant themselves to aphid attack.
That's Dr. Joshua Teer from the University of Melbourne's Australian Research Council speaking to Emma Field about aphids. And while a test has been developed for the gene he talked about, it's not commercially available yet. Well, it was a bleak outlook for one of Australia's key players in the wine industry yesterday, Treasury Wine Estates, with stocks tumbling and the two largest and most profitable international markets shrinking, as Jane McNaughton reports.
Shares of Treasury Wine Estates plunged by 10% to less than $5, making it one of yesterday's worst-performing stocks on the Australian market. This is off the back of the winemaker, which features iconic brands like Penfolds, delivering a worse-than-expected trading update and cancelling the remaining portion of its $200 million share buyback. It's forecasting sharply lower operating earnings for the first half of the 2026 financial year. Updating shareholders on Wednesday, the company said it would cut consumer inventory in the US and China, stripping out as many as 700,000 cases of wine from the global market to cope with an ongoing reduction in wine consumption. The update was the first from the new Chief Executive Officer, Sam Fisher, who has declined to speak with the ABC. CEO of Australian Grape and Wine, Lee McLean, says as Australian exports approximately 60% of the wine produced in the country, the entire industry is at a crossroads with big players such as Treasury Wine Estates at the coalface.
I'm not going to comment on the individual circumstances of any one company, but what I can say is that around the world at the moment, including here in Australia, we're facing probably the most difficult set of commercial conditions that we've seen in generations, if not ever before. We know grape prices are incredibly low. We know that there has been a significant decline in demand for wine in most of our key markets globally, and that's led to a really significant sort of structural issue that we have in Australia. So businesses here in this country and around the world are all making difficult decisions about their operations and how they position themselves for what looks to be a pretty rocky road ahead. We export about 60% of what we make in this country. So exports are really important to our viability in the long term. And what we've seen over the last couple of years, we've seen a significant challenge in China placing import duties on Australian wine for a number of years, which effectively locked us out of that market. But we've also seen a decline in consumption to the levels that are about the lowest since 1961 globally for wine. So it is a really challenging set of circumstances, pretty much no matter which part of the sector you're in at the moment.
Speaking of exports, there was a lot of discussion yesterday on the Treasury Wine Estates share market update. The grey market in China, which is basically unauthorised sales of Penfolds, was a large part of the discussion. Is that a problem more broadly for wine that's going into China from Australia?
Certainly, there's always been more exporters of wine to China than producers here in Australia. That's long been an issue. It's not necessarily a widespread issue, and of course it varies from brand to brand. From my perspective, when I look at the China market, it's still incredibly important to us. It's still our largest market by a long way, but it has softened compared to where we were a number of years ago. And I think some of those issues around businesses making decisions about that market, you know, whether they be decisions around parallel imports and the grey market, as you've mentioned, or whether it is just decisions about their focus in that market, given the softening in demand that we've seen over the last little while, they're decisions that companies are certainly looking at.
CEO of Australian Grape and Wine, Lee McLean, ending that report by Jane McNaughton on the wine industry, and ending the Country Hour for today, taking you back to the cricket shortly, and another Country Hour after midday tomorrow online and on radio.